Hey everybody, my name is Amy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Amy.
And Gabby, thank you for asking me to come up here and speak. You know, there's nothing more I like to do than to talk about myself and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's like it kind of chokes me up a little bit to see. I don't get to see the effect my sobriety has on other people all the time, right? You know, I have to have people tell me because I'm a little hard-headed. So I appreciate what you shared, you know, and I remember that. It's like I used to see John and Gabby together at all the meetings we went to together. And, you know, we shared a home group together for a while. And so I'm really grateful that we're able to reconnect like this. So thanks so much. Thank you for the food and the hospitality. Very welcoming. I appreciate an eating meeting. So I'm going to share with you tonight what it was like, what had happened was, and what it's like now. Just as it's outlined in the book, my job as a sober alcoholic is to help carry the message of the solution to my problem and your problem that's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the details of my story are not going to be exactly the same as yours, but we share a common bond, right? You know, that I can't take a sip of alcohol, you know, and know what's going to happen next. That's like the definition of alcoholism in a very simple form. So my story starts like everybody else's story. I was born, and pretty much the same. Everybody starts the same place. So, you know, my parents met in college, you know, and they got married because of me, because I came along. And, you know, I have a sister, and, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic household, right? My mom is one of us, and my dad was definitely an Al-Anon for sure, and, you know, he drank heavily. But he was not an alcoholic, right? I know what that difference is today, because I ended up marrying a man who drank heavily and was not an alcoholic. You know, so it wasn't like our house was constant turmoil. You know, we had, you know, roof over our head, food on the table. We had, you know, Christmas, presents at Christmas, birthdays. We did all that stuff, clothes on our back. We were clean. You know, we went to school. My parents are educated people. But my mom was an alcoholic, right? So there was, you know, you walked on eggshells a little bit. You know, you never knew when she was going to get drunk, right? I could wake up to go to school in the morning. My mom's still sitting there drinking from the night before. There was, you know, fighting and violence. But that was normal for me, right? You know, it was normal for my parents to sit down when my dad got home from work, and they would just start drinking at 5 o'clock and just drink all night and read and watch TV. And that's how I grew up. And I didn't think anything differently of it until I, you know, got a little bit older, right? That's not normal. But drinking is a big part of my family. Like my mom's side of the family, alcoholics. Dad's side of the family, depressives, you know? So it's like they came together to form this beautiful marriage and raised two really healthy children. So that was normal to me. My whole mom's family drank, you know, I knew from a very young age that I was going to drink and I was going to smoke cigarettes, right? That's what I knew. You know, my parents used to let us have like champagne on, you know, holidays, wine on holidays. And I remember when I was little, they would drink beer and they had this little Stein glass, shot glass, and would scoop the head off the beer and let us drink it, you know. So it's like, it wasn't a big deal, right? It wasn't a big deal. And, you know, it actually was a big deal, you know, as I got older. But, you know, I had my first drink when I was 13 years old. You know, when I was growing up, you know, all the cool kids drank and partied and did stuff like that. I mean, I was in the eighth grade. You know, the first time I got drunk, it was eighth grade graduation. I was in the park. Some older boys had some beer, you know, and I had two beers, and I was hammered. And, you know, I instantly had consequences the first time I drank. Instantly. And I'll share about that more later when I talk about the steps. But, you know, and it's not like the first time I did it, I was like, I had arrived. And I tell myself, I would tell myself this lie that I wasn't an alcoholic from the jump, right? It's always the end of my drinking that's much worse than the beginning. Like, I was an alcoholic then. You know, I was just a party girl. But that's not true. Like, from the moment I drank, the only thing I really wanted to do was drink again. And at 13 years old, it's really kind of hard to score alcohol. So it's not like I was a raging drunk right off the bat. Right? You know, but every chance I could, I would drink. And I would rope my friends into it. You know, I was always the catalyst of, like, let's steal some wine coolers. You know, let's do, you know what I mean? Let's get some cigarettes. You know, I was always that person who was trying to get other people to, you know, do bad shit with me. You know, and when I was, you know, that was fine. You know, it's like I chose a path when I was young, and I was pretty bad when I was young, but I kind of straightened myself out a little bit. You know, went to high school, graduated high school, was going to college, but in that time, you know, I started working in restaurant industry, right? And that, oh man, for someone like me, it's perfect, you know? I was a waitress, you work in the front, all the guys in the back have drugs. You know, you get anybody, it's like I was 18, you can convince anybody who worked there to buy you alcohol. You know, it wasn't that hard, you know, and so that's when I really started partying, you know, and experimenting with drugs as well. Drugs are definitely a part of my story. I'm not a drug addict, I'm an alcoholic, because I was able to put all those things aside, but not alcohol, right? I mean, I can... If I'm going to 8-ball cocaine, I'm going to have alcohol with me. It's not going to be like I'm going to have an 8-ball without alcohol, right? But I'm drinking without cocaine, so that's just the way I partied. But, you know, so I set my life up from the beginning where I can drink. I was in the restaurant industry for 25 years, right? It's like the perfect career for an alcoholic. Nobody's drug testing you. Nobody is getting mad at you because you're not showing up for work. You can show up for work hammered, and everybody's just glad you're there. You know, so it's like, I wasn't going to have a straight job where I had to show up and take a shower and go in there and, you know, not be, you know, still drunk from the night before. So that's what I did for a big chunk of my life and a chunk of my sobriety. I met my husband. He was a bartender. Right? That's how I met my husband. I met him in a bar. Right. And those are the kind of aspirations I had. You know, I'm going to marry a bartender. Right. Perfect match. You know, most girls dream of marrying a doctor, lawyer, whatever, businessman. I married a bartender. That was the move for me. When I was younger, I was a big party girl. I lived in Atlanta, went out all the time, went to clubs, went to shows. You know, I was that person. You know, I had a punk rock job. I worked at Fellini's Pizza. That was cool as hell. And, you know, that's what I did. I had a lot of fun when I was younger. I had a lot of fun partying, right? Everybody in here, at one point, it was a good time, right? Everybody I hung out with drank like I did, right? So it's not like, hey, you got a problem, Amy. Everybody was doing the same thing. This is the life we all live. And a lot of those people were non-alcoholics. Some of them definitely were. But, you know, that's not for me to decide. You know, I got married. I started building a career as a chef in the restaurant industry. A friend of mine, he was opening a tavern, and he had me, you know, he's like, I want you to help me build this. So I had this good career opportunity, and he was opening a tavern. I was going to be the chef, and that's like, the point where everything started going downhill. We built the tavern was in East Point. I lived in Atlanta, right? So it's like I was down there a lot. You know, my husband worked in Atlanta. we were very separated, you know, until we got off work. There's no way you can be in the restaurant industry and be married to somebody else who's in a different field. You'll never see each other. But so I was down there all the time, and when I would get off work, right? So I was in the kitchen, just to say, this is the kitchen. This is the bar, right? So I would walk out of the kitchen when I got off work and just sit at the bar. So it's like I didn't even go home until that place shut down, or we would go to another bar. And this is, I mean, this is really when my drinking accelerated. When I reached the point of not having a choice in whether I drank or not. And we think about, you know, I think about the times when I would sit down at the bar and I would have a beer, right? A beer. And this was like maybe in the middle of a double. Like, I'm going to have a beer, just one beer. And it was really difficult because the only thing I really wanted to do was to finish my shift so I can drink for real, you know, so I didn't have any other obligations to keep me from drinking the way I wanted to drink. And in that 3 years, I started, you know, I'm selfish and self-centered, and I was going to only do anything that's going to benefit me. Right? It didn't matter that I was hurting other people. And for a long time, even into sobriety, I thought my behavior was such that, you know, it didn't matter. It didn't matter. I was doing what I wanted to do. And it didn't matter if I hurt other people. You know, so I started cheating on my husband. He couldn't see all the way down to East Point from Atlanta. You know, my day was this. It's like I would come to, you know, come to, not wake up. I would come to, you know, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, still drunk, have to get myself together so I can go to work that night. And every time I would be so brutally hungover. I'm like, I'm not drinking tonight. All right. I get to work. And I'd get off work, and I'd sit down at the bar, and I'd drink. I'd drink till that bar closed, then I would go to another one. When that bar closed, I would go home and drink there. Did I mention I was married to a bartender who also worked at a liquor store part-time? So that house was stocked. Stocked, man. I'm talking, you know, full bar, wine, beer. I hope I'm not triggering anybody, but, you know, drugs on the table. It was like we were ready, good to go. So everything I needed was at my house. And then I'd pass out, repeat the same thing over and over and over again. There was one point, I was like on a Sunday, I was off work, and I was hungover, and I was thinking to myself, I was like, I can't even remember the last time where I was, you know, sober. Like where I wasn't drunk, I wasn't sleeping, and I wasn't hungover. I couldn't remember the last time that was something that happened for me. And I mean, you would think that would be like, oh, then I stopped drinking and went to AA and everything was great. No. I had a little more further down to go. You know, it's like same thing over and over again. Eventually, I stopped eating. Like, I stopped eating. I was eating for show. You know, my body's covered in bruises because my liver's breaking down. I'm not really sleeping, obviously, because I'm passing out. That's not true rest, as I found out once I stopped drinking, when I was able to sleep 15 hours a day. You know, I was cheating on my husband whenever I could. I was lying. Like, I had my life compartmentalized. But because I was like, because of the alcohol, I no longer had a choice in whether I drank or not. Those things started, like, that my compartmentalization stopped working. Like, these people over here weren't supposed to find out what was going on over here, and that, it happened. You know what I mean? The blocks started falling. And you know, my life started becoming a mess, a big mess. And, you know, my last drunk, I was, so I always like to make this dramatic. You ever seen the movie Goodfellas? Right, you know that scene I'm talking about where Ray Liotta gets up in the morning and the first thing he's doing is a line off the dinner table and then starts his day. It's my favorite scene in that movie. And I always like to think about my last drunk like that. And, you know, my ex-husband was going on a fishing trip with his friend in the woods. I'm like, he is out of the picture. I'm going to do what I want. I woke up at 2 o'clock, went and got some brunch, which is air quotes for the recording, but brunch consisted of me pushing some eggs around a plate and drinking mimosas, right? And then I went to my little neighborhood bar. I used to live in Cabbage Town, and there's like everything's in walking, stumbling distance. So I went to my little neighborhood bar, started drinking there, went across town where I go play poker on Sunday nights and drank there. And then I came back to my little neighborhood bar to close it down at midnight. So, and this is like still being drunk from the night before. And I'm sitting at that bar, I'm doing a shot and drinking a beer, and I'm like, I can't do this anymore. Like, it just hit me, just how pitiful my life was. And then I couldn't go on drinking the way I was, or living the way I was. So, I finished that drink, I made a decision, and I walked home, and I was like, I'm not going to live anymore. This is my decision. I'm going to kill myself. And so I got home and I got a bottle of beer and a bottle of Tylenol PM. And I popped open that beer and I chugged half of that bottle of Tylenol PM and washed it down with my last beer. Wrote a suicide note to my husband, put it on the table. And then I called my job and told them I wasn't going to be in the next day because I was going to kill. I'm killing myself. And, yeah, I got to call in, right? I know this now, but that's definitely God doing for me what I could not do for myself. And, you know, the girl I work with, she's like, you need to call an ambulance. I'm like, I'm not doing that. I'm not calling an ambulance. I'm fucked up. There's no other way to put it, you know? And I'm like, she's like, I'm calling Mike, who's my friend and my boss. He's like, I'm calling Mike. Go sit on the front porch. And, like, my boss comes peeling up, you know, picks me up, scoops me up, brings me to the hospital, emergency room, you know. And the first thing they do, I'm like, I always laugh every time I go anywhere, you know, in sobriety, any sober function, and somebody's got these red plastic party cups. Why are we drinking out of these? So I get to the hospital and they're like, okay, because I took all those pills, they have to give me the charcoal, right? And they serve it to me in one of these red party cups, you know, and I have to chug it. You know, I threw up everywhere and then I passed out, you know, woke up the next day. I'm like, my boss is gone. Obviously he has stuff to do. Nobody knows where I am. You know, I wanted to escape from the emergency room so bad. And I could not move my body. That's how sick I was. That's how physically ill I was. I mean, like, my clothes were disgusting. I'm like, oh, God, I was gross. And, you know, and I had my little cell phone with me, and they had to call my mom. We had to call my friend who was able to get in touch, no lie, get in touch with the ranger at this park my husband was fishing at. You know, she was able to do that, you know, so he could come home and... you know, doctors are in there going, how much did you have to drink? I'm lying. And they're like, they know I'm lying. You know, I'm like, I had two drinks. And they're like, no, you didn't. Okay. People do not end up in the hospital having a couple of drinks, you know. But I thought I could pull that off. So they took me. They were like, whatever. They had to find a place for me, right? They can't just be like, okay, Miss Mathis, go. Oh, I'm not anonymous. They're like, you can go home. And so they put me in DeKalb Crisis Center, and I mean, I was in the emergency room for like 16 hours, just laying there, and they took me to DeKalb Crisis Center, and I was like terrified. I was absolutely terrified because I knew the jig was up. Right, when I was in high school, people like would get busted for smoking a joint, and their parents would send them to rehab, and I was like, losers, you know. I'm like, I thought that rehab was for the weak, right? For people who couldn't handle their shit. And now I'm one of those people who couldn't handle their shit. And so I was in there for 5 days, you know, and fully intending on drinking when I got out. Like, I'm like, this is just a little rest, you know, when I get out of here, I'll drink and then maybe I'll see, get this sobriety thing a shot. You know, while I'm in there, I didn't realize, like, this is where I found out I was drinking myself to death. You know, my blood pressure was like 203 over one something, you know, it was bad. You know, they have to put you on all sorts of medications so you don't go into DTs. I'm also on psychotropic drugs so I don't go crazy. And, you know, the doctors are like, yeah, you know, you're really close to cirrhosis. And, you know, if you keep drinking the way you are, you're going to die within 6 months. And I don't know if y'all are alcoholics like me, but that was not even like a scare tactic to me. Like, that didn't even scare me that I was going to die. I was upset and I was crying because I couldn't drink. Death is not, straight people do not understand this. Death is not a deterrent. It is not, you know? And I can say, this is a meeting Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not going to bring up the drugs, but people don't get it. People don't get it. And, you know, death, like me drinking myself to death, the bruises all over my body, my high blood pressure, I wasn't going to stop. And like I said, I fully intended on drinking when I got out. And the day that I got out, you know, I didn't drive, right? Like, my life is set up in such a way, I didn't drive cars because I would have killed somebody. I'd still be in prison today. Probably the smartest decision I ever made in drinking, to not drive an automobile. So I was waiting outside of the rehab for my ex-husband to come pick me up. And I had, you know, what we call a moment of clarity. And I realized that I couldn't drink. Like, I was done. I had to be done. And, you know, instead of going to a bar, I went to an AA meeting. And I decided, you know, this is what happened, right? You know, I decided to go to an AA meeting. So part of my story is, when I was like 21 years old, my mother got sober. She had some pretty bad consequences, and she got sober, and she was going to AA, right? And right when I turned 21, right, this is when I'm warming up. Like, I'm just getting into the game. And so my mother, not once, right, not once was trying to get me to stop drinking. We all know, if we've had any time in this room, we know we can tell an alcoholic, but you can't tell them much, right? There's nothing I can say that's going to make you change your mind if you want to drink, and there's nothing I can say that can make you change your mind if you don't want to drink, right? That's the way this thing works. But my mother never once said, you know, you need to stop drinking, da, 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 you know, never threw out those suggestions. And if she did, I was probably drunk and didn't hear it. But when I told her, you know, when I called her, I'm like, I'm done, you know, I'm going to start going to meetings. She drove down, gave me this 12 and 12. She didn't give me the big book, but she just like gave me these books and was like, here, you can read these. And this, you know, I haven't had a drink since then. And that was, you know, God willing, I'm not planning on drinking, but in a few days I'll have 18 years sobriety. I don't say that to brag. I say that because it's a miracle. Like, it blows my mind all the time. Like, I can't believe I haven't had a drink in that long. So my story is this, right? So I started going to meetings. I went to as many meetings as possible. I was super pissed off. I was super angry that I couldn't drink anymore. I'm like, I never noticed when I got out of rehab, I never noticed how many alcohol commercials for alcohol at work. I feel like every single commercial on TV was about Bacardi rum, marshmallow vodka. You know, it's like all this stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. And I'm like, how did the beer aisle in the grocery store get so big? You know? So I'm angry. I have all this stuff. Like, I'm like hyper aware of alcohol. And, you know, I'm still married to a bartender. I'm living in a house filled with booze. And I have a job in a bar. Okay? This is when I get out. And I'm just going to meetings. And there are people I've known for a while who are like, oh, I remember you. They used to call me Angry Amy because I was so angry all the time. And I was not happy to be there, you know, to say the least. But it was still, AA meetings were the only place I felt comfortable. I'm like, I need to keep just going to these meetings, right? Anytime I shared, it was such a newcomer share. And, you know, it was terrible, and I was angry, and I didn't have any solution. Because I also decided that, you know, I looked at the steps on the wall, and I'm like, I'm not doing any of that. I mean, the first step, maybe the ninth step, I don't know about that one either. I'm like, I'm just going to do the first step, and I'm just going to do this the way I'm going to do it. I'm just not going to drink and go to meetings. That doesn't work. That's not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't drink and go to meetings. But you know what? Sometimes that's what you need to do to begin to hear the message, right? So I went to a lot of meetings. I went to a lot of speaker meetings. You know why? Because I couldn't relate. Like, if I was brand new and I walked in this room, I'm like, I don't believe any of y'all. None of y'all drink like me. You're laughing. What's so funny? You know, I didn't believe it. I thought it was bullshit. And so I started going to speaker meetings, right? And people would share their stories, and I started to relate to them, right? Not the getting sober part, but the drinking part, right? So that kept me coming. Eventually, I started having experiences that y'all were talking about, you know? I started experiencing the things that happened for people who worked the steps, but I wasn't working steps, right? I started having deep and effective spiritual experiences. I had this one time, I had about 60 days sober, and I worked in a bar, right? I got off early on a Friday night, and I was sitting at the end of the bar, smoking a cigarette, drinking a Coke, playing those little crack boxes, those machines with the games on them. We used to call them the crack box. They probably don't have them anymore, right? I don't know. I haven't been in a bar in a long time. And since everybody has a phone now. But so I was sitting there, and I'm like, you know, I think I can go to my neighborhood bar and just hang out and drink Cokes. And then I was like, no, Amy, you cannot. No, Amy, you cannot go to the bar and drink Coke. You know what I mean? It was like, it hit me like a hammer. And I'm like, oh, God, that's the sanity. Like, it's like, that's something happening, you know? And it was exciting and different. I was having these changes happen. So I've managed to pull together a year, right? I managed to pull together a year not drinking and going to meetings. At the end of that year, I was on the fence. I was like, I felt like a fraud in AA, you know, because I wasn't doing the work. I didn't have a sponsor. I wasn't calling anybody. You know, I just started, like, going out to lunch with people when they would force me to do it. And, you know, there was this guy in this meeting I used to go to, Henry, and he was the guy who rounded up people for speaker meetings, right? And he would wait. He would stop people, wait till they got a year so they can get them to tell their story. So he had me tell my story, and it's all, like, no, zero solution, all drunk a log. And when I finished telling my story, I'm walking through the parking lot, and this woman shouts out at me. She's like, hey, congratulations on a year. Now you need to start working some steps. And I was, you know what I mean? She was right. Because you know what? My thing was, here it is, right? Accept spiritual help. Or go on to the bitter end. That's the alcoholic conundrum, right? I want to go on to the bitter end. I know what that looks like. That feels comfortable. Except spiritual help, that's scary as hell, right? And it's either I was going to do the work or I was going to drink. Like, literally, I was like, that was the plan. So I asked, finally got the courage up, and I asked, I asked this woman to help me work steps. And it turns out she got sober right around the same time I did. She has 2 weeks more than me, right? She's still sober to this day as well. And she helped me. The biggest difference was she came in, she got a sponsor, she did steps, she started helping other people, right? You know, she was starting on this path of happy, joyous, and free while I was still in misery. And so she helped me. She helped me work the steps. I'm going to talk about the steps a little bit. My life as related through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become unmanageable. That's cake, right? That's the easiest, hardest step you have to take, right? You know, because right after that, it's like, well, you know, now I can't take a drink one day at a time for the rest of my life if I want to stay sober. Because my life was, you know, unmanageable. I had lost the choice in whether I drank or not, right? It wasn't fun anymore. I couldn't live without it. Two, came to believe a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. You know, the God steps, and I'm not alone in this at all. There's a whole chapter in the book called We Agnostics that convince us the solution to our problem is spiritual in nature, right? And it gives us instructions on how to start seeking God of your understanding. Whatever the hell you want to call it, I don't care. My higher power is God, and that's the term I use. You know, so I was able to come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore sanity. I gave you an example, right? And that happens over and over and over again throughout my sobriety. Number three, this is everybody's favorite, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Right? The God steps are also very confusing. I like homework that I can complete an activity and I'm done. You know? Yeah, I got the first step. You know, the fourth step, I'm like, cool, I get to write stuff. The God steps are more nebulous. It's ongoing. It's you know, it's tough to talk about. We don't want to talk about that. It's difficult for me to explain my relationship to God, and that's not what I'm here to do today. I'm here to let you know that I made a decision at a point in my life to trust something greater than myself so I can go through the rest of the steps so I can be free from the obsession to drink alcohol. That's the solution. And I did that not really understanding what that meant, right? I had to do that so I can do step 4 and 5, right? So I had to do the inventory, which everybody's terrified of these two steps. These are terrifying. Not quite as terrifying as 9. So I made the inventory, right? And then I sat down with my sponsor, admitted to God, to another person, admitted to God, to myself, another human being, the exact nature of my wrong. So when we do the inventory, we're looking at our resentments, right? We're looking at all the anger, all the resentment, everybody who was the problem in my life, not me, right? Wrote that down, looked at it, and then looked at my part in it. My sponsor today, she likes to talk about resentment as this suitcase that she's dragging around with her, right? So, like, I'm like, yeah, I have this broken down 70s Samsonite. You know, one lock works, one doesn't. Maybe one of the wheels is busted off, but I'm dragging that with me. You know, full of resentments everywhere I go. You know, and I was able, when we wrote those down and talked to him with my sponsor, was able to start letting that stuff go. I was angry at my mother because she's an alcoholic and she didn't love me. She loved my sister more. Same thing with my father, you know. And my sponsor had explained to me, and this is why you sit down with another person, because they give you perspective. She explained to me, you know, your parents love you. They're doing the best they could, you know. This is my perspective. I didn't feel loved. I was able to forgive my parents and let that stuff go. My mom keeps coming up on the inventory, but, you know, hey, that's what it is, what it is. That's going to happen. It is going to happen. This is why we got to continue throughout our lifetime. We got to continue. Then we have the fear inventory, right? You write all the fears you have down on this list. Everything. Doesn't matter how stupid you think it is. Spiders. I'm afraid of spiders. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, every fear I had on my first inventory, every single, like, I'm afraid to drive a car, afraid to, you know, I'm afraid to grow old, I'm afraid to die alone. Like, the real, like, that stuff, gone. Gone. I got my driver's license and sobriety, and I'm driving cars now, obviously, because I'm up here in Canton. They don't have buses out here. You know, so I was able to, like, let go of those fears. Fears crop up, but I have tools to handle those today. All right, let's talk about this one. This is the one everybody doesn't want to talk about. Sex inventory. Woo! We don't talk about this enough in meetings, and I'm not going into dirty details, so don't get everybody get their phone out at once. So I told you about my first drunk. I was drinking beer in the park with boys, 13 years old. I lost my virginity to one of those boys, right? That's a consequence of my drinking. That is not a decision I would have made if I wasn't drunk, right? That also set in motion my sexual romantic relationships for the rest of my life, like up until today, right? This is that change that skewed my outlook on those kind of relationships. I'm very single right now. I'm cool with it, but you know, all this stuff, like all the shame and fear I had around all those, my whole entire sex life up until that point, I was never telling anybody any of that stuff. That's the stuff that goes in the ground with Amy, right? I'm not telling another human being. But at this point, when I sat down in front of a complete stranger and I told her all of that stuff, and she didn't bat an eye, she didn't care, right? We all have those stories. We all have that, carry that shame. But I was able to tell her and let go of all of that shame, you know? And throughout sobriety, we look for ideals, right? We look for our sexual ideal. Like I said, we don't talk about this in meetings enough. I feel like everybody shies away from it. But it's a humongous part. Bless you. It's a humongous part of each one of our stories, right? Not saying we don't have to get down and dirty about it, but, you know, we can talk about it a little bit, how it made us feel. It's a whole chunk of our inventory. It's important. All right, let's talk about 6 and 7, right? Everybody, damn. I've been talking about this in 2 meetings in 2 weeks. Entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Everybody's like, well, there's only 2 little paragraphs in the book. I don't know what to do. And yeah, I didn't know what to do. And I didn't do it for a long time. I did not get rid of any of my defects of character. I'm like, I'm not drinking. I'm good. Right? Eventually, I had to start letting go of those things. I became willing to stop being so angry, to stop being such a jerk. I was a terror sober. Like my first 5 years, the only thing different about me is I wasn't drunk. You know, I behaved exactly the same. It's only over time I was ready to let go of a lot of those things, right? And I'm still working on that. They come back. They come back for sure. The second I stop doing any work, they come back. But step 6 and 7 is just, you have to do 2 things. Become willing and humbly ask. That's why there's only 2 paragraphs, right? The most overthought steps in the whole program. All right, 8 and 9. Make a list of amends. Make a list of people you hurt and make amends to them. Direct amends. You go up to them and you say, you know, I'm here to, you know, not apologize, but make amends for any harm I have done to you. You know, what can I do to make it right? I have to ask the other person. No expectations on the outcome. I can't expect everybody to be super pumped that I'm not drinking. Right? Mine went really well, you know? Mine went really well for some reason, you know? Especially, it's like, probably, you know, one of the hardest ones is to make to my ex-husband, whom I just treated like dirt. And, you know, he was very forgiving. Probably more forgiving than I deserved. But these steps are terrifying to me. And, like, having to make amends to this day, I don't want to live my life where I have to make amends, so I try not to. And when I do, and sometimes people have to tell me, what the hell, you know what I mean? Some people have to point out my character defects, and then I have to think about it, and I have to make amends to them. I don't like that. So I try to live my life in such a way that I don't have to do that. All right, let's get into the meat and potatoes, what I need to do to stay sober. I'm sorry, am I sharing too long? So 10, continue to take personal inventory when we're wrong, promptly admit it. I gotta constantly look at my stuff every day. Go through that inventory process, right? You read the 10-step promises at the beginning of this meeting. Those promises are probably, like, we read the 9-step promises at a lot of meetings. 10-step promises are where it's at. Like, the first time I read those with my sponsor, I was in absolute tears because every single one of those promises came true for me. And I hadn't even started working 10-step. You know, looking at all my character defects every day, you know. I'm not going to go through all the steps on that. But here's this one is my jam right here. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of Him, His will for us, and the power to carry that out. I have to constantly seek God every day. You know, the third step, I have to make a decision every single day. Am I going to trust God or am I going to trust Amy? Is it going to be God's will or Amy's will? Am I going to ask God for direction, or am I just going to be like, nah, I got this. I'm gonna go ahead and do what I want to do. Most of the time, it's a mix. You know, sometimes I start off the day doing what I want to do, and then I'm like, oh, God, I got to ask God, help me out of this one. I do have a prayer practice. Meditation practice is a little weak, but, you know, after many years, it's like I'm seeking outside of AA for other spiritual paths. It says in the book, you know, we shouldn't shy away from looking for other, you know, going to church, you know, seeking other spiritual solutions. This is not the only one. You know, AA picked, you know, cherry picked some stuff for what we have today to give us direction, to help find another God so we can rely on God more than just the third step to take us through the rest of the steps. Right? This is what keeps me sober. The reliance on my God. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. The whole point of the steps is to... So I have a spiritual awakening so I never have to drink again. I try to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. And it is a practice, right? Progress, not perfection. If I'm practicing this, I'm... You know, moving away from a drink closer to God, right? Simple as that. The best way that I can do that is to help other alcoholics. Now, we're going to talk about, I know I'm selfish and self-centered, and I don't want to help anybody. When people ask me to speak, this is part of what I do to carry the message. I do help other women. I have some women in my life right now that I have been working with, and it's probably the best experience I've had with sponsorship and helping other alcoholics. You know, I have some women I really love and care about right now. They also say, you know, intensive work with another alcoholic helps when nothing else is available, right? I'm not going to think about myself if I'm telling you about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, what is it like now for me, right? My life is, I don't want to say centered around Alcoholics Anonymous, but it is, the program is a humongous part of my life, right? I have a sponsor. I sponsor other women. I have a home group. I have service position in the home group. I'm active in other meetings. You know, I fellowship. Most of my friends, all of my friends pretty much, except for the people I work with, are in AA or in recovery, right? Trying to do the same thing I'm doing, trying to stay sober one day at a time. In the time I've been sober, I've been divorced. I know you've heard me mention that. Sometimes there's nothing better than a good divorce. I didn't drink over that, you know. My dog died, I didn't drink over that. That was harder than the divorce. We got a little country song going on here. My father died of cancer. Now I know I didn't walk through that with as much grace as I thought I did. I was an asshole, but, you know, I did the best I could. And I tried to be there for him at the end. And not much I could do about that. He died really quickly. That was a long time ago, though. What else? My grandma died, you know, and I'm like the executor of her estate. You pick this drunk girl, right? This is the executor of her estate. At 41 years old, I went back to school to get my degree. Because when I was younger, I quit school to go work and go manage a restaurant so I could just drink as I wanted to drink, right? Set my life up to live it the way I wanted to live it, right? And then I'm able, through AA, there's no way I could do this without being sober, right? I'm able to get my degree, and I have this like amazing, super straight job today. I'm an insurance agent, you know. Outside of being an accountant, that's probably one of the straightest jobs you can have. It's super straight. But it's like I have this great life today. I own my own condo. I have a car. I got my driver's license, you know. When I was 38 years old, I got my driver's license, and I have a car. That's a big deal. You know, I used to ride my bicycle to meetings when I first got sober. But I mean, these are all, whatever. The material stuff isn't what's important. It's what's going on in here and up in here. And, you know, also through this program, so I've had something recently happen to me. Not happen to me. This is not about me. But, you know, my mother's sober, right? My mother's been sober over 30 years. She's not as active in AA as I would like her to be, but that's my problem. We discovered my sister had been, like, secretly alcoholic. And, you know, through a series of events over the past 6 months, you know, she's been in rehab and getting sober. But, you know, so we had our suspicions, but you can't really be like, hey, you know, we think you're drinking. You can't really just bombard somebody like that because it's the first thing they're going to do, lie. They're going to lie, try and cover it up. And, you know, my sister called me and was like, yeah, I'm drinking too much. I can't stop. And, you know, so to know that, you know, my sobriety is such that somebody else would call me and ask me for help. And it's, you know, one of the hardest things I had to do. She got sober for a little while and then went back out. And one of the hardest things I had to do was sit across from my sister and 12-step her and, you know, share pieces of my story while she's just shit-faced drunk telling me she's not done. You know, that's hard. And it's like I understood and I had to walk away until she was ready. And if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I would be dead. But I wouldn't be able to help somebody else at that capacity. So, you know, my life is rich and full. And, you know, today I don't have a desire to stop drink. I don't have a desire to stop drinking. Freudian slip, right? You know, I don't want to drink. It's not even a thing for me. I was at a big dinner for work last night at a very nice restaurant. They're all drinking, having wine. I'm cool with whatever they do. They all know I don't drink. It's not a problem for them. It's not a problem for me. That problem has been removed, right? And I'm able to enjoy life. Other things, it doesn't matter. But I just want to close with this. You know, this is probably my favorite thing that's written in any AA literature, and it really sums up the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, remember, practice, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. Thank you for letting me share my story tonight.